the retail industry is experiencing disruption, and we're talking about what this upheaval means for the stores we frequent now and in the future. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Major retailers closed more than 5,500 stores last year, but that was actually down 32% from 2017, when store closures peaked at about 8,100. Those numbers from Core Site Research, that's a retail think tank. What do you think is behind the struggles of today's retail industry? Is it just the Amazon effect, as they say, or does that not fully explain the situation? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Mark Pilkington is a retail executive and strategy consultant. His new book is called Retail Therapy: Why the Retail Industry is Broken and What Can Be Done to Fix It. Mark, welcome to the Ideas Network.
It's great to be with you, Kate.
So just in recent days, we've seen the downfall of Payless Shoe Source file for bankruptcy protection, closing about 2,500 locations. And that's just one chain among many that's called it quits in recent years. Has retail ever seen anything like this before?
No. We've seen individual retailers, usually weaker brands, go under, usually one or two every 3 or 4 years. But we've never seen the number of major brands go under or suffering bad sales on the scale that we've seen over the last few years.
So put this in context before, because you wrote that in 2015, we had started seeing this escalation of the most severe crisis to ever hit the global retailing industry. What kind of numbers are we seeing?
Well, you quoted the numbers very accurately. I mean, 2017 was the worst year ever. It was different sources say between 8,000 and 9,000 major league stores closed. And that was higher than in the Great Recession of 2008, when only about 6,000 closed. And that, of course, was in a deep recession. You kind of expect some damage. But, you know, the 2017 numbers were occurring in a growth economy where all the economic indicators were very favorable. So it was very unusual to see that happening. Now, 2018, as you said, was marginally less bad, although still pretty bad. The effect of the tax cuts has been to boost, in the short term, to boost consumer spending. And that has given some retailers, a kind of reprieve from the threat that they're facing. But my belief is that it's a fairly temporary reprieve. And if the economy ever returns to a more static type of situation, which is inevitable at some point, then we're going to see some very further widespread damage to the retail industry.
Well, as more and more stores go dark, you start to wonder how many more are left to go out of business. I mean, will we see a plateau here?
Well, I think the problem with retailing is that, you know, retailing works because you have a certain critical mass of stores in a location, whether it's a main street or whether it's in a mall. And once the number of stores that are active in that shopping center drops below a certain level, the whole mall or shopping center can start to go under because it becomes a fairly unattractive place to go. There's nothing more ghostly than a half-empty mall. And I think that the danger is that the loss of a certain number of stores may tip the whole mall or shopping center over. Even the sort of, quotes, good stores, the ones that are still perhaps performing well individually, can get dragged down by the communal decline.
We're looking at the chain stores and the department store closures and the mass liquidations that are going on with Mark Pilkington as our guide. He's a retail expert, author of the new book, Retail Therapy, Why the Retail Industry is Broken and What Can Be Done to Fix It. Gathering your thoughts along the way, your questions are welcome at 800-642-1234. Do you work in retail? How has your community been affected? How have you been affected? And did you see this coming? Call in. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Mark, has this crisis touched all sectors of the retail industry? Are luxury stores and discount stores struggling both?
Yes, it has actually affected all areas. I mean, discounting has done, if you like, better than many other sectors, but there are still a large number of discounters that are struggling. Luxury Luxury, of course, is an international business and has been in recent years very dependent on China for its growth. So in a sense, the US retail situation is not the only factor that is affecting the luxury industry. Nevertheless, I would say over half the total number of luxury brands have seen pretty major sales declines over the last 3 or 4 years. There are some that are still doing well, but certainly the industry as a whole is not what it was. And then between those, you've got the mass of the mid-market stores, and that's really where the maximum suffering has occurred. As you say, with department stores being at the front of the queue, we've really seen a devastation of the department store industry, which has been happening, you know, in a sense, since the sort of early 2000s, but it's really accelerated. I mean, the number of store closures that people like Macy's, JCPenney, Sears, Kmart have been closing is really colossal. I mean, someone like Sears, I mean, Sears is just about still alive, but it's cut its number of stores from nearly, I think, around 5,000 down to now somewhat less than 1,000. So it's really a shadow of what it used to be.
And that's a lot of square footage to figure out what to do with. I mean, think of the massive amount of those department stores. What do you do?
Well, the problem is, of course, that a lot of those department stores were anchors for malls. And when you've got the sort of 200,000 square foot spaces in a mall, it's very, very hard to fill that kind of space. And the malls themselves are suffering. There's a website called deadmalls.com, which is tracking the decline of the mall industry. And there's around 450 malls on their lists, which is around a third of all the enclosed stores in the United States. So around a third of the malls in the U.S. are either already closed or in severe decline. You know, it's a very highly leveraged industry, the mall property business. So there's a danger that we'll see some of those big groups going under as the retailers decline.
Let's go take a call now. Let's go to Joe joining us from Neenah. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning. Mark, I haven't read your book, but I do have a comment to make. I, as a consumer, I'm looking for one item. I try to go around and secure the item, and no one has it, or no one has a version of it. Why does the retail industry realize that competition is going to kill them? Why don't they cooperate? Why don't they offer a different variety? Even Best Buy, giant stores like that, tell me, go online and get it. We don't carry it in the store. And they may offer the item I'm looking for online. So if they're telling us to go online and they don't want to stock it in the store, or they all can't figure out in one mall how to offer different versions of the thing so that I can find what I want, then they're all going to go under. There's only going to be a few left that have what I'm looking for, or I'm just going to go and order everything online and retail's down. I'll give you a specific example. In Derby, Connecticut, when Home Depot moved in, there was a small shop, hardware store, that was thinking that maybe it'll have to go out of business. They analyzed Home Depot stock. They looked at where the weaknesses were. They looked at where their opportunity to offer specialty items was that Home Depot didn't offer, or versions that Home Depot didn't offer. They survived today, 20 years after Home Depot moved into that small town, because they knew how to do it.
Joe, I'm going to pause right there, and we're going to get an answer on the other side of this break with Mark Pilkington. We're talking about the retail industry sea change and what future stores may look like, especially as big box stores go bankrupt. Retail analyst Mark Pilkington is our guide. He's author of Retail Therapy. Your thoughts are welcome at 800-642-1234. Retail workers, how has this upheaval in your industry affected you? What do you think can be done to save traditional retail or your local mall? Can it be saved? Call in, tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation, and we'll look at this particular question in just a minute on the Ideas Network. We're looking at what's become of the retail landscape in our communities and what forces are at work as companies file for bankruptcy. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And I myself grew up near Southdale Mall, the birthplace of America's enclosed shopping mall. It opened in 1956. I remember walking into that airy, sun-drenched atrium of Donaldson's department store in the dead of winter, right about now, with all that spring break, swimsuits on display, the bright sunshine reflecting off all the colors of the suits. It was inviting. Definitely first of the season, nothing on sale. And then when Mall of America opened up in Bloomington in 1992, there was this such a big deal as hundreds of stores under one roof and a theme park in the middle. Southdale, Mall of America are still open, still trying to stay relevant in the Twin City suburbs. Do you remember department stores of your childhood? What became of them? And what do you think the store of the future should look like? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Retail analyst Mark Pilkington is our guide. He's the author of Retail Therapy. Mark, before we had to go to a break there, Joe and Nina asked that, you know, why don't these retailers cooperate? Why don't they diversify their offerings and they just push you to go online to get things? What's going on there?
Well, the caller's question really points to the fundamental problem of retailing as a method of sort of supplying stocking goods versus the internet, because the internet companies can put much bigger assortments together. For example, if you look at one of the biggest big box retailers, Best Buy, they have about 80 options of televisions in their huge department stores, but you know, Amazon has over 500,000 options of televisions. So, you know, it's much easier to have a huge assortment online because you only have electronic walls, whereas, of course, in retailing, you've got physical walls, which limits your assortment. I think as to the question as to whether why retailers don't band together and perhaps segment their offer more so that as a total, perhaps in one mall, they offer a wider variety, I think the sad truth is that, you know, retailers are not really used to cooperating together. They're used to competing with each other, and they still see the other retailers as their competition. I'm not sure all of them fully appreciate that the real threat now is not really from their fellow retailers, but from the online players. They don't have a tradition of cooperating, I think we see that they're struggling to sort of come up with a new model. But it's an interesting idea whether, you know, perhaps in one mall they could agree that they would only carry certain products and have a logical category management, if you like, to provide a greater choice to the consumers. That's a very interesting idea.
Simon Property Group, which is the number one U.S. mall owner, they recently said that they were prepared for this mass exodus of closures, and they hinted that there are more bankruptcies to shake out this year. Is there any way mall owners can be prepared for such a dramatic shift?
I mean, I think that, you know, all the mall owners, I mean, if you look at their share prices, they've, you know, the stock prices have been very badly affected over the last 3 or 4 years. So the market is obviously reading in more than is being perhaps admitted by the industry. There is a very substantial asset gap between the net value of all these properties that are being held on the balance sheets of the big mall owners and their stock market valuations, which means that the stock market is looking at the underlying value of their assets in a very different way. And the question is, who's right? I think the stock market's right. And what that means is that a number of these big mall groups are going to have to, in the next year or so, take some very big write-downs of what they're carrying on their balance sheets. As to what they can do about it, I think that this is something that is similar to what individual retailers can do, which is that the mall itself or the shopping center has got to be given a greater degree of specialization and a greater degree of entertainment value than it has at the moment. Both individual retailers and malls are no longer necessarily the best way to supply goods and services to consumers, or certainly goods. But in terms of the live experience that you can have in a physical space, a mall or a retail shop, there are still things that you can, that the experiences you can have that are not, you know, are more than what you can get online. The problem is that the malls are used to having about 80-90% of their space being, you know, high-yielding retailers, whereas actually what they need is a higher mix of food and beverage and general entertainment services, which would make the malls much more interesting to visit. And it's the same with the individual retailers. The individual retailers devote virtually no space to how they interact with customers. I mean, most of the space is just full of stock, like a glorified warehouse. And it isn't actually really giving anything that can't be got online. So to differentiate, they need to invest much more in the sort of front-end customer experience.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up that front-end customer experience and diversifying at the mall. I checked in at Southdale this morning, and they're opening a fitness chain Lifetime inside that's called Lifetime Work. That includes co-working space, exercise, you work, you shop, all under one roof. It's opening in the fourth quarter of this year. And, you know, are you seeing malls reimagining their spaces like this? I see in the Deep South, mega churches take over vacant malls.
Yes, I mean, a number of uses have been found for sort of unused mall space. I mean, there's one that's been turned into a kind of university. Amazon actually has taken over a very famous mall, which was one of the first sort of dead malls. Amazon's just taken it over as a distribution center. So some of it is being repurposed. But I think, you know, the issue is going to be, you know, whether it can be done fast enough to avoid some quite substantial financial write-downs and problems in that industry. Really, the future lies in creating spaces where people really want to go for more than just the goods that can be got. Because, as I say, that bit, I think, is almost better done over the internet. It's got to be something more. It's got to be more of a live experience, an entertainment factor, and a place where people can feel a sense of community, which they can't get, obviously, on their phones using the internet.
We're looking at all facets of what's happening to chain stores in this time of mini closing. Mark Pilkington is our retail expert, author of Retail Therapy, Why the Retail Industry is Broken and What Can Be Done to Fix It. You can join in. There's a line for you at 800-642-1234. What is the situation like in your community? Have stores closed and other stores compensated for that in any way? Are the voids being filled? And if so, by what concept? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Mark, let's talk for a moment about the Amazon effect. Amazon is far from the only e-commerce website to basically siphon off business from traditional brick-and-mortar retailers, but you can't argue with the scope of what Amazon has managed to do. How specifically, you know, has Jeff Bezos and his website contributed to what we're seeing in this retail upheaval?
There's no question that the internet as a whole, and Amazon specifically, is probably the, I mean, there are many reasons actually for the retail apocalypse, if you want to use that word, but obviously the internet is a major one, and Amazon is the sort of leading edge of that. You know, when you look at the fact that Amazon has, that the retailers have allowed Amazon to control around 44% of the total U.S. online market, and the online market is growing exponentially, whereas the stores business is a lot flatter. You know, this is a, you know, it's a very, very substantial crisis for the retail industry, because in 5 or 10 years' time, it's likely that the share of the online business will be up, you know, into the mid-20s. And at that point, if Amazon still has half of it and the retailers have none of it, they're going to be also rams in that race.
Well, Paul from Eau Claire emailed us to say that online retailers provide better paying jobs than brick and mortar, and the customer gets the exact desired item for less money. What's not to like, Paul asks. What do you see there from that approach, that the jobs are better and you get what you want?
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at the supply chain that we've been living with, you know, pre-internet, you had, you know, factories selling to brands and brands selling to retailers with their stores, and then the retailers selling to the consumers, and each of those stages was adding a lot of markup such that goods ended up in the stores costing 7 or 8 times what they cost to produce in the factories. There's no question that the internet coming along and disintermediating the cost of the stores enables them to offer considerably greater value to the consumers. And part of the problem for retailing is that, you know, as rents have risen and as the squeeze has been put on them for profitability by their owners, that, you know, the share of the pie that's gone to the retail workers has got less and less and less. And we see that in two forms. We see it in the form of less staff, fewer staff, you can't find a member of staff. And secondly, that the retail has gone from being a decent paying, stable job with pensions and a long-term career, which is what it was 20 or 30 years ago, to being a sort of part of the gig economy with zero-hour contracts and no pensions and these kind of things. It's definitely become, you know, a very, very minimum wage type of occupation. And one of the things that, you know, the internet companies have been able to do, because they've chopped out all the costs of the stores and the rents and everything like that, is that they are able to pay their people a bit better. The downside is, if I can just go on a bit, is that there are far fewer jobs being put into the internet businesses than they're being lost from the retail businesses. They reckon that around, it only takes one person to produce $1 million of online business, whereas it takes about 3.5 people in a retail context. So
let's pause right there, talking with Mark Pilkington about what the future blueprint looks like for retail stores as we see thousands of store locations close each year. When we come back, we'll look at how retail can be saved. News is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the future of shopping and what to make of the upheaval as we see thousands of stores go dark. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So far in 2019, store closure announcements are up 23% versus this time last year, and more are on their way as a result of several major bankruptcies and more expected. The retail research firm CoreSight predicts store closures this year to look a lot like what we saw in 2017 and 2018. So what do you think can be done to save traditional retailer? Retail, can it be saved? Does it need to evolve? And what do you think the store of the future should look like? We're at 800-642-1234. Email your thoughts to ideas@wpr.org. Mark Pilkington is a retail chief executive and strategy consultant, and his new book is called Retail Therapy. Mark, before we get into the fixes, can we just look quickly here at the generational shift? Baby boomers, who were the big spenders in recent decades, they're starting to downsize and slim down their spending. And naturally, retailers are now looking to millennials to pick up the slack. Is that happening?
No, it's not. The problem is that there's quite a severe generational imbalance in wealth, which is building up. People in the U.S. over 45 own 85% of all the assets in the U.S., all the wealth, and the people under 45 only own 15%. People are worse off relative to, you know, their peers 20 or 30 years ago in all of those younger age groups. One of the prime reasons for that is the property prices, which, of course, have exploded over the last two decades. And it's left, Generation Z and millennials unable to afford to buy property of their own. So they're living in smaller spaces. There's evidence that they're not getting married and having children at the same ages as they used to. So in terms of them moving on with their life stages and consuming a lot of products that go along with those change of life stages, this is not happening in the way that we expected. And that's having a big effect on the sorts of retail businesses that younger people support, like fashion, you know, beauty, sort of home products, people setting up homes for the first time. That's having a big effect on those types of retailers.
You also have a chapter in your book called The Death of Brands. Are we just not as interested anymore in buying what established brands are selling?
Well, one of the things, apart from the internet revolution, that technology has brought is what we call the informational revolution. If you look 20 or 30 years ago, most of the information that consumers got about brands and products was from the brands themselves through their advertising. And actually, consumers were quite passive in the process as brands and retailers pushed their products at them. What's happened now with the development of social media, with influencers, with peer-to-peer reviews, with price comparison sites, is that the consumer is armed with much, much greater information than before and is much more able to make up their own minds. And so they're getting their trust from other sources, and really branding's about trust. In the old days, you got your trust from the big brands with their big sales forces and their big advertising budgets. These days, you can get your trust from your peers giving something a five-star review. You don't need to pay all that money to gain the trust in the product. So new products and new brands are emerging now, which are going viral because they've got a great product or a great service. They're getting great reviews, and they're getting traction very, very quickly. And the younger generations that we've talked about are seeming to be very, very open to these new brands. In fact, they're often preferring them. They think they're much cooler and more trendy than the big incumbent brands, which have a, you know, a very old-fashioned approach towards marketing. So, yeah, when we talk about the death of brands, we don't mean there's not going to be any brands, but the degree of protection that the sort of big brands had in the old days isn't there anymore.
Let's bring in Paul joining us from Middleton now. Hi, Paul. What are your thoughts on this?
Good morning. Yes. Well, I'm really disheartened by the demise of the department store. It was a lot of childhood memories. But I think the one thing that always stood in my mind, besides the sensory experience of going to the department store and the great displays that they had, was that they were also service-connected. If you were bringing children in to get trousers and they had to be fitted, there was a tailor there to do it. Boom. End of story. And I think that's one area where department stores could separate themselves or make themselves relevant, because they provided service in addition to the quality of the material or the quality of the goods that they sold. And because e-commerce can't do that for you.
So you felt like there was this human connection to the goods. Yeah.
Very much so. Oh, yes, very much so. And I think there was another thing for me. I guess I can remember November 11th. I know I was less than 5 years old. We were at Haynes & Company and another great old department store like Lord & Taylor and B. Altman and Bambergers and the like. And the chimes went off and everybody went quiet. And I looked to my mother. I said, "Why is everybody quiet?" She said, "Shh, quiet, quiet." Okay, I'll be quiet. Well, when the chimes ended and the time had passed, I said, "Well, what happened? Why?" She said, "Oh, it's Armistice Day.
Mm.
We're, you know, paying honor to those who lost their lives in the Great War." Now, here's what I'm a generation removed from the generation that fought the First World War. And so here's a history lesson being passed on to another generation who knew nothing of the First World War.
Paul, thank you for those insights. Mark, what do you see there?
I think absolutely Paul is right. And this is the area that retailers and malls have to focus on, which is the personal service and experiential element. The problem is that they devote so much of their resources to what I call stock management and stock fulfillment, that it leaves very, very little resource left over for them to offer unique service or experiences in stores that the internet can't match. They're investing in the wrong things because they continue to see themselves fundamentally as providers of goods in stock in huge big box stores. And, you know, the problem is the internet's got a bigger box and it's cheaper to ship direct to the home. So it's that role model of retail being a fulfiller of goods is being usurped by the internet. And what they need to do is to shift the balance within their stores, devoting less space and less time to stock, because stock takes a lot of the staff's time. Less space, less time to stock, and have more of it devoted to the actual experiential and service element, and upgrade the staff so that the staff gives a really, really good service to people, and have more of the stock actually shipped directly via the internet rather than all taking up so much space in the store.
Is this what you mean by a lean store model?
Absolutely. To my view, the days of the big box, you know, 200,000 square foot stores, that's over. It's obsolete.
So even stores like Walmart or Target that have really prided themselves on their size, or IKEA out in the suburbs selling furniture, stores even like those would work on a smaller footprint?
Yes. I mean, in fact, IKEA is experimenting with a smaller footprint at the moment in Europe. And what they're doing is, you know, because furniture takes up a huge amount of space, as you can imagine. So what they're doing now is they're having selected stock in more city centers. They're mainly out of town stores, so they're moving into city centers, having a smaller selection of actual physical stock in the stores, but a lot of digital screens and lots of equipment and experiential elements that enable consumers to try things virtually and have things demonstrated to them virtually, and then they place the orders and they ship the actual furniture directly to the home.
You say that another benefit to this model is allowing stores to move places to where they normally wouldn't be able to operate. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the thing is that, you know, 20, 30 years ago, the model was that, you know, when you grew up, you got married, had kids, etc., everyone moved out to the suburbs. And that's where a lot of the malls have been built, and that's where a lot of the retail property is. But the problem now is that, you know, millennials and Generation Z, they're delaying a lot of these things, and they're staying in the city centres, and they're living in smaller accommodation in the city centres. So that's where the sort of vibrant activity is happening. And a lot of these big box stores, they can't actually, they've got too big a footprint to go into the city centres. So they're not where the young consumers are.
Let's go to Troy joining us from Muskego. Hi, Troy. What do you think here?
Yes, I think this is a big generational gap here. I'm a Generation Xer, so I'm in between baby boomers and millennials. And one of the things I think is, this is actually a really good debate to have with boomers, because they're constantly saying, you know, you got to buy this, you got to buy American, you got to buy brick and mortar, you got to support things. And at the same time, my generation, it's about whatever we can afford. Like, if there's a big wage gap from generations, and so it's almost like if I want to sustain the same type of things that I grew up with, that I saw the adults purchasing or own those same things, I have to go online. I have to find the cheapest, and I have to shop where I can get the cheapest thing, just so I can have those things, just to make ends meet.
So, Mark, Troy is basically saying here he has to find the least expensive price. It is absolutely not about service. It's about cost.
Well, Troy's hit the nail on the head there, because that's the point. There's this generational inequality. Troy and his generation are losing out, and they're doing the intelligent thing by shopping around in the places where they can find the best deals. They really have no choice, and they're finding those great deals through the internet, and they're finding those great deals through new brands that have cut out a lot of the stages of the supply chain to provide that generation with better value for money. They really have no choice but to do that.
We're exploring the longer-term trends that are dogging the retail industry with strategy consultant Mark Pilkington as our guide. His new book is called Retail Therapy: Why the Retail Industry is Broken and What Can Be Done to Fix It. Your fixes are welcome at 800-642-1234. How do you imagine a better way to buy the things that come up in life? From your Target list to your Amazon list to needing a pair of waterproof gloves when you lose one in a snowdrift. Call in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the future of retail as thousands of stores liquidate and then go dark. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Author Mark Pilkington writes, brands must have an overarching philosophy, which involves some kind of contribution toward making life better. Simply selling things is not enough. Do you rely on trusted brands? And do you see a future where stores carry a handful of products, like display rooms? We're at 800-642-1234. Mark Pilkington is a retail expert, author of the new book, Retail Therapy. Let's go to Jessica now, joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
You know, you were talking earlier about brands and why millennials don't buy brands. And the one thing that I've noticed as a millennial is that brands, especially the big ones like Unilever and Walmart and all of those, I guess Walmart doesn't count as a brand, but, you know, many of them are found to be really, really unethical. And as, you know, we're armed with so much more information these days, I think a lot of millennials, at least anecdotally from my point of view, feel this really incumbent responsibility to pay attention to the things we're buying and the impact that supporting certain businesses has. So I think that's a reason many of us aren't buying brands, because we notice that they're really unethical and we don't want to support that.
Mark, what do you make of that, that responsibilities and ethic come into our shopping habits and our purchases?
Well, if we go back to this very long supply chain with its markup of 7 to 8 times, there's an awful lot of cost built into that system that isn't really useful. I mean, you know, for example, I used to work for a big brand. It had a huge sales force that used to go around the stores and sell to the stores. The stores had buyers who bought from those salespeople, and then the stores had salespeople who sold it to the consumer. That's a waste of time. I mean, it's just double working. And one of the things that the new brands are doing is that they're designing a supply chain that is much more direct from the producers and the factories to the consumers. And that's freeing up a lot of cost. It's freeing up a lot of resource that is enabling these new brands to act much more ethically, to pay the workers in the factories properly, to pay the people who are in their businesses properly, and to give back to society. Whereas the traditional branding model, so much of the money is going into all this superfluous activity, all these stages of the supply chain that you don't really need, that the people who are producing the goods are being pushed down, the people who are selling the goods in the stores are being pushed down. There's really no money available in the system for some of the key people, and that's leading to these kind of ethical abuses, like, you know, these kind of sweatshop factories where people die in these fires, and which happens all the time because, you know, the costs have been screwed down so far to pay for all these markups. And I think that the great thing with these new brands that are coming through, these direct-to-consumer brands, is that they're offering not only a great product and great service, but they're actually able to work in a much more generous way with all the key people, which is really the producers, and to treat their workers properly. And those are the brands that are winning out with, you know, younger consumers.
Well, I think what you're saying here echoes with what Pete in Reedsburg has emailed. He said in recent months he's bought stuff branded Patagonia, Columbia, and Hanes, and he says he bought all of them online from the actual manufacturer, not from retailers like Macy's or Walmart. And he says there's big disruption coming to the wholesale distribution model and the brick-and-mortar stores that depend on it, and it's pretty hard to compete with the people who make the stuff. Is he on to something?
He's absolutely onto it. I mean, you don't need those stages in the supply chain. I mean, people are just going direct. And, you know, there are Chinese factories now that are supplying through AliExpress, which is the consumer side of Alibaba, the big Chinese internet company. They're supplying into places like Russia and into the Middle East straight from Chinese factories at incredibly good prices, without all the cost and the hoopla of, you know, having all these traditional brands and stores.
Well, where does government come into this? What do you see as the role of government or communities in helping the retail industry survive and thrive in their own community?
Well, I don't believe that the government can, you know, like, bail out the retail industry. The government is doing a few things at the moment which is a very, very bad for the retail industry, kind of unconsciously. One of the things they're doing is the tariffs, because the tariffs are pushing up the costs of, you know, Chinese products, which the retailers depend on. Another thing that the governments have not really caught up with is the tax situation. Internet companies pay vastly less tax than retail companies, because retail companies are really easy to tax because it's obvious where they are location-wise. Internet companies, they can be in different places, and it's harder to tax them. So those are the two main areas where the government, I think, can help the retailing industry adjust. But unfortunately, they seem to be very unaware of the consequences of their actions. And, you know, retailing is the biggest private sector employer in the United States. About 15 million people work in retailing. So if the government doesn't sort its act out, it's going to find itself with a very, very severe economic problem.
So who else has a stake here in fixing retail? Because some of these fixes are going to be costly for retailers that are already in the red.
Well, I think that the retail, this is why I focus a lot on things like the lean store concept. I mean, retailers are being told that they have to do thousands of things. You know, they have to invest in their stores, improve their experiences, pay their people more. They have to invest in having their own internet operations and set up their own logistics for internet. It's all adding to cost at a time when their sales are reducing. And that's why I came up with the idea of the lean store, which is if retailers want to put the money in the right places, they've got to stop spending it in the wrong places and save some money. And one of the biggest areas that they're really wasting their money is in having these huge big box stores and having their staff spend over 50% of their time processing stock. It's just a waste. And that's where I think hopefully my formula offers a unique contribution. It shows them where they can save money and then move the investment into the bits that really matter.
Can you give us some examples of retailers or businesses that are already pushing toward this type of model?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of innovation happening in China. For example, Alibaba, which I mentioned earlier, one of the internet leaders in China, they've just opened a new range of supermarkets where they stock around 50,000 products, but only about 3,000 of them are physically present in the store. And the 3,000 that are present in the store are very, very fresh products. They're like live seafood. It's more like a European market where people are cooking things and preparing food in front of you and you can sample it all. So it's very much like a really live, fun experience. And then the other 47,000 products you can buy, you know, through screens and things like that. And they're delivered, I think, within 2 kilometers of the store, within 30 minutes or an hour, which means that, you know, they're not filling these stores up with lots and massive stock levels of packaged products, etc. They're really using the store as a vehicle to sell a lot of stuff online. And really their stated intent is they want to actually help move people online. So that's a good example of innovation of the sort I'm talking about.
Well, in the last minute we have with you, with all of this being said and with all of the demise of stores here, are you feeling at all optimistic about the future of retail?
I think that the changes that are happening will lead us through to a better place. Just as the Industrial Revolution massively reduced the cost of manufacturing, this is effectively a distribution revolution, and it's going to massively reduce the cost of goods. And I can see a more perfect future where stores will be great, smaller, but great entertainment and service centers where you'll get personal shopping, you'll get given a really nice experience, maybe given a glass of champagne or a beer or your favorite coffee, and really treated properly. And most of the work will happen online. And so I do see a better future where consumers can get products, instead of having to pay 7 or 8 times the factory cost, they can be paying maybe 2 or 3 times. So it is a value revolution that's going to take us to a better place. The problem is there's going to be an enormous amount of disruption on the way.
Mark, thank you for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure.
Mark Pilkington is a retail chief executive and strategy consultant. His new book is called Retail Therapy: Why the Retail Industry is Broken and What Can Be Done to Fix It. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.